Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 on this not-so-lovely Sunday afternoon in December. Today we have a show I've been waiting for a long time. We're going to have one of the leading journalists and economists and editors on the program today talking about his new book. Our guest is going to be Robert Kuttner, editor of The American Prospect and author of the new book, The Squandering of America. I think this is a show you're going to really enjoy, so sit back, relax, and let us do some yakking at you today. In the meantime, before we get started, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Media consolidation is continuing to squeeze out minority TV station owners, according to a new report. The new figures show that the number of minority-owned commercial TV stations has dropped in the past year by 8.5%. Hardest hit were African-American station owners. They plummeted by 60%. People of color now own just 5 of the 845 Big Four network-affiliated stations nationwide. Much of the decline can be attributed to a change in ownership of a single company, Granite Broadcasting, which was the country's largest minority-owned broadcaster. S. Derek Turner, research director of Free Press, is the lead author of the study called Out of the Picture 2007.
There are so few minority-owned television stations to begin with, so when you lose a single owner, it actually led to a really sharp decline in the level of minority ownership. And African Americans owned about 19 stations just a year ago, but now that's dropped all the way to 8 stations, which is a 60% drop.
Turner also found that minority-owned stations are particularly vulnerable to increased consolidation.
One of the broadcasters that sold a station over the past year sold one of the stations, and he's about to sell the other because he can't compete against the bigger, large corporate broadcasters in his market. And he has a really hard time securing advertising contracts and getting programming deals, and he directly attributed that to the increasing level of market concentration.
If FCC Chairman Kevin Martin lifts the long-standing ban on one company owning both a daily newspaper and a radio or TV station in the same market, minority ownership would suffer serious negative consequences.
If the Martin rule goes through, it will put a bullseye on those minority owners in those top 20 markets, basically artificially raising the value of their stations temporarily as an acquisition target by the cross-owned media companies like Tribune and Belo and Gannett.
Turner says the best, most effective way to boost minority and female ownership is to roll back consolidation.
What's stunning about this report is how much things can change in just a short period of time, and the trend is definitely heading downward. And we strongly feel that unless the FCC steps in and does something to roll back media market concentration, that these low numbers are going to get even lower.
For more information about Out of the Picture 2007, go to stopbigmedia.com.
A rare event took place this week as New Jersey residents packed into an FCC public hearing to help determine if Fox-owned affiliate WWOR, the state's only VHF TV station, should be able to renew its broadcasting license. Senator Frank Lautenberg asked the FCC to hold the hearing. The station has unusual public interest obligations because of the unique character of the New Jersey media market, which is split between Philadelphia and New York City and leaves state residents with very little local TV coverage. Chuck Lovey of Voice for New Jersey, an organization dedicated to improving broadcast coverage in the state, says that things were different when the station first came to Secaucus.
I think at the time the owners took their obligation seriously, but once the license was felt secure, and certainly since the change of ownership to Fox Television, the coverage of New Jersey has steadily eroded, and it really culminated with the branding of the station as My Nine New York. They've taken on a purely New York identity, they've turned their back on New Jersey, and that's the essence of why we're challenging their license renewal.
My Nine NY responded to the criticism by having their news team pull up to the hearing site with the NY portion of their logo on their vans and gear hidden behind masking tape. Lovey says the city of Newark does get some coverage, but when Voice for New Jersey analyzed broadcast coverage of the other five largest communities in the area during a 15-month period, the news was dismal.
Jersey City has 240,000 people. They only got 13 news stories in that 15-month period. Patterson only had 8 news stories. Elizabeth had 2 news stories in 15 months. Elizabeth is a community of 120,000 people. Edison had 4 news stories. Woodbridge, community of 97,000 people, had 1 news story in 15 months.
The FCC has until February 1st to make a decision. For more information, visit voicenj.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 2nd, 2007, on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone I've been wanting to have on the air for a long time. He's one of the leading political economists in the United States, a founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, an economist, an accomplished economist, and a journalist who's written widely for a number of publications, including a terrific column for years in Business Week, and the author of numerous books, probably most notably Everything for Sale, which came out in the 1990s and was really central to a lot of the thinking people were going through as they were dealing with the Reagan Revolution and the neoliberal epoch. And now he has a brand new book out, which I'm delighted to have had a chance to read, and we're going to be talking about today. That book is The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Robert Kuttner, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
If I can ask you, first of all, why did you decide to write this book? What was your thinking behind it?
Well, I deliberately picked an alarmist title because I think events are alarming. When I wrote Everything for Sale, I tried to explain why some parts of the economy worked well as markets and others didn't. This book is more about how the political domination of the choices that we face by economic elites is narrowing prosperity, narrowing political choices, and really pushing the economy to the brink of a crash. And we're seeing a crash in slow motion in the form of the subprime meltdown. I was a little bit worried about my timing, but I think the timing has been pretty lucky.
I mean, this is an alarmist both in your title, but now also in your short description. What is your view, looking forward for the next, 6 months, year, 2 years, 3 years, what does the immediate American economic picture look like to you, or what's the range, is maybe a better way to put it?
Let me do long-term, short-term, and let me answer that question first by referring to what's been going on for 30 years. Since the 70s, we've had widening income inequality, widening economic insecurity, of good jobs, of health care, of retirement. It has become more difficult for somebody who doesn't have affluent parents to make it into the middle class. So you have what I call a hidden depression as the prologue for what's going on at this moment. Then on top of that, you have had increasing financial deregulation, allowing the financial economy to revert to the kind of casino that it was in the 1920s. Looking forward, the best case, I think, is that the Federal Reserve will keep lowering interest rates and bailing out big banks so that you don't have a repeat of 1929, but those bailouts are not costless, because basically what Bernanke has done is to lower interest rates below the level that he otherwise thought prudent in order to bail out Citigroup and the other big banks. And, of course, that's not costless, because it means a cheaper dollar. It means more expensive gasoline and home heating oil. It means a weakening of the United States in global markets. And the thing that's just shameful, it seems to me, is that if you're going to bail out these guys with one hand, you have an obligation to do some preventive regulation before the fact. So I think the best case is that will avoid a real catastrophe, but the spillover effects of the subprime crisis, coupled with the underlying inequality of the economy, will produce a fairly serious recession. And then the question is whether the Democrats draw enough distinctions between their view of the economy and the Republican view of the economy so that they can really offer a different set of choices and pull the economy out of the recession and transform the kinds of limitations that financial elites have put on our political choices.
You know, Robert Kuttner, we're jumping now way through the book. You've already touched on some of the themes you discuss in lucid fashion in the book, financialization of the economy, growth of inequality, the nature of what it means for actual living standards of Americans. But, you know, you've gotten right to the point of the argument of the book, at least one of the core arguments at the end, which is the political response. And one of the things that was really striking to me as I read your book was you're talking about how all these economic phenomena have been taking place in the United States for the last three decades, but they've pretty much been stripped out of political debate, campaign rhetoric, or discussion issues.
Yes, and you're right. I did cut to the chase. Let me now do a little bit of the backstory. The economy between World War II and 1973-74 was a much more equal, balanced, fair, and regulated economy. And as I explained in The Squandering of America, there's nothing about the new economy that changes the instruments of how you make for a more balanced form of capitalism. They include regulation, progressive taxation, social investment, and trade unionism. And nothing about technology changes that. Nothing about technology makes capitalism more self-regulating. The only thing that's changed since the 70s is the politics. Financial elites have gotten stronger, and countervailing forces like the labor movement and the power of government itself and mobilized voters have gotten weaker, and that creates a vicious circle whereby voters look at what Democrats are proposing, and if Democrats are not proposing anything that really looks like it's going to help them in a practical way, voters say, what the hell, I'll vote for the tax cut. And that's the vicious circle that we have been in. And every instrument that makes for a more balanced economy has been stripped out. Democrats as well as Republicans have colluded in the financial deregulation, the poster child of which is now the subprime meltdown. The deregulation of other sectors of the economy really started big time under a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, and most of these experiments in deregulation have been practical failures. Electricity is probably the biggest single case where the states that deregulated have had dramatic increases in rates, and the states that kept the thing regulated have not. You can make up your own mind about whether airline deregulation is a splendid success or a failure. And, of course, the deregulation of labor markets has weakened trade unionism and increased the disparity of earnings. And the failure of the government to use social investment to keep up with the changes in the society, the most dramatic one of which I think is work and family, where both parents are working or there's a single parent working and you don't have social institutions to take care of the kids, that's not just bad for us as people, it's bad for the productivity of the economy. And then during this same period, the tax code has become more and more regressive, more of the tax load is shifted on to the payroll tax, which is the most progressive tax, regressive tax that we have, and the whole employer-provided system of health insurance and retirement coverage is collapsing. So instruments that could be used to redress this imbalance and to make for a more balanced form of prosperity, every one of these has been stripped from political discourse.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner, author of the brand new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. A book, I might say, for those of you in the audience who are not economists but are interested in politics and interested in the relationship of economics to politics, provides, for my money, really one of the best overviews and explanations and assessments of all the dominant economic trends of the last few decades that are coming to a head right now. So I strongly recommend it at that level. The phone number here for those wishing to call in and speak directly with Robert Kuttner is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mr. Kuttner, as I was reading the book, deep in the book, there's a discussion about focus group work being done with some working class Americans, and they're talking about their economic insecurity and the trials and tribulations they face in the United States today. And you made the comment that what was striking about this discussion was that when they were asked, well, what could the government do to improve the situation, they came up with a blank. They had no idea that this was something the government could actually affect for the better and act on. And when I read that, it was striking. And it was striking also because it seemed to me that, in a way, this was the complete victory of what's called neoliberalism, of the idea that the economy is sort of a scientific entity that should be left alone and politics should not touch.
Yes, and I think the difference between this era and our parents' and grandparents' era is that you never would have gotten a focus group in 1948 of working-class voters coming up with that verdict, because in that era, the things the government did to help ordinary people were tangible and were familiar and were transformative. We had the GI Bill, and we had the first generation of FHA loans, which together helped make for the great post-war middle class. We had Social Security. We had public works. And, of course, we had strong unions. And so any working-class voter or middle-class voter of that era knew that there were things the government could do, had done, needed to do, that helped ordinary people. This is why it's such a vicious circle. And I think when those instruments of redress are taken away and are not part of people's consciousness, people give up on politics. My one difference with Tom Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, a writer and political analyst who I really admire, is that when Frank says that people, particularly working-class voters, who vote for Republicans based on social issues are acting out of a kind of false consciousness, and if they knew what was good for them, they'd vote for Democrats, that would be a lot truer if Democrats were offering people things that could transform their lives. And because of this premise that the voters don't like government, or that something new about the economy has changed to make government to make the economy self-regulating, or national health insurance would be too expensive, Democrats propose these small bore token programs and then have very little credibility, and so you get this vicious circle of defeatism and passivity on the part of voters. And let me just add, there are some wonderful exceptions to that. One of the reasons I don't just give up and slit my wrist is that if you look at the 2006 midterm, every single Democrat who took back a Republican seat took it back not by scuttling to the center, as the pollsters advise, but by running as a full-bore, flat-out economic populist. And guys like Sherrod Brown show that there's another path where you can win election by, once again, doing what the Democratic Party did in its heyday, and that is serving as the champion of ordinary people.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner. And Mr. Kuttner, I want to talk about the politics, and I know our listeners will too, and what it means in the coming election and the candidates and the issues being debated. But I'd like to do a little more of the backstory if I can. I think it's been a common theme now accepted by many Americans, whatever their political views, that indeed economic inequality has grown for better or for worse in the past three decades. Your book, I think, does as fine a job of sort of laying it out as I've seen. And, you know, one of the arguments that's been used across the political spectrum by Republicans and Democrats is that if we have economic growth and increase the productivity so there are more goods and services to be distributed amongst the people, that economic growth will be the engine of rising living standards. And you, I think, do a nice job of taking that issue apart. Maybe explain to our listeners the relationship of growth and productivity and politics.
You know, the idea that there's something about equality that is bad for growth, or there's something about growth that solves equality, is a very convenient myth that serves financial elites. You have had periods of strong economic growth that were also periods of greater equality, like the period in the 25 years after World War II. You've had other periods of moderate to strong economic growth, which did not increase economic equality, which actually decreased equality. And other things being equal, economic growth produces tight labor markets, low unemployment, low unemployment produces better working, better bargaining power for workers. So, you know, in a very crude way, growth is good for equality, but the presence or absence of equalizing institutions, progressive taxation, regulation that gives workers more bargaining power, social investment, that's a lot more important in whether you get equality out of your growth. And also, by the way, when you throw away the rule book and don't have financial regulation, you end up with scandals like Enron and the bubble economy and the crash of the late 1990s and the subprime meltdown. And, of course, that's bad for economic growth. The whole challenge is to harness capitalism so it serves broad prosperity and not allow a kind of capitalism that gives you periodic crashes, which is bad for growth and bad for equality.
You know, again, for our younger listeners who might not recall the era that Dr. Kuttner is talking about and that I've lived through myself, I think you give some very strong examples, like in terms of college tuition and some of the really important markers of being able to have a middle-class living standard that have changed dramatically over the course of the last two generations.
Well, there was a time when government really helped ordinary people get into the middle class. There was a period when the average working person could afford to become a homeowner, when college tuition was moderate, when there were great public universities and community colleges that people could afford without saddling themselves with huge loans, and when health insurance was provided by employers. And a lot of this was the direct result of public policy. And one by one, these policies have been stripped, and policies, new policies that we need because of new things about the economy, have not been part of the public debate. Policies to ease the stress of being a working parent, policies to make sure that unions have the rights, workers have the rights that they supposedly enjoy under the Wagner Act to organize or join unions without being fired. And one thing I've advocated is a national commitment to make jobs in the human services good jobs. You know, there was nothing about manufacturing in the heyday of the blue-collar middle class that inherently required high wages, as we have learned when we see manufacturing jobs go to Mexico and to China, where products are manufactured with the same degree of worker productivity, but workers get 19 cents an hour in China and maybe half a buck in Mexico. It was trade unions that enabled these jobs and required these jobs to pay good wages. We need to do the same thing with human service jobs so that any job taking care of a young person or an old person or a sick person is either a professional job or an occupation with adequate training that leads to a professional job. And all of these things are things that public policy could do if you had the right kind of politics and the right kind of leadership undergirding it.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Robert Kuttner, author of the new book, The Squandering of America, just recently published. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. The telephone number, if you have a question or comment, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. One of the issues you take up in the book, Mr. Kuttner, that I found interesting as well and valuable was that oftentimes we read today that the reason why there is such growing inequality is the changing nature of the economy, that these new technologies are such that only people with very sophisticated and high degrees of training and education can benefit from the economy, and less skilled workers by definition just are going to be losers. And as a result, the solution is not a political solution as much as it is just ramping up the training and education of the workforce. This is a strong argument. We hear it all the time. What is your response to it?
It's at best a half-truth. Think about American history. The blue-collar middle class of the 1940s and the 1950s, most of these people didn't even have a high school degree, a diploma. Certainly they hadn't gone to college. But they got decent wages. They got a high enough wage that they could become homeowners and become part of the blue-collar middle class. That was because of better minimum wage regulation and stronger unions. nothing whatever to do with education. And if you look at some of today's workers, go into a photo finishing counter at your local drugstore and take a look at the computer that the person who is printing out your prints, if you haven't figured out how to do it at home yet, take a look at the computer that that person is working with. Take a look at the computer that the teller in your local bank is working with. But those people make $8 or $9 an hour, and that's a function of the lack of unionization, the lack of bargaining power on the part of workers. Now, it's true, other things being equal, that more education will allow you to earn more money. But I think what we don't do in this country is combine training and retraining and education with an economy that has a decent distribution of wages and salaries. And in many of the countries of Northern Europe, they put a lot more money than we do into what's called active labor market policies, so that if you lose your job in manufacturing, you will be trained for a better job in services. And they can do that because they have strong unions. They have a national policy of not permitting huge disparities between wages in different sectors of the economy. And they don't just train you and leave you to your own luck. They make sure that there are jobs on the other end. And by the way, even though Scandinavia gets a very bad press in conservative America, they have a lower unemployment rate and a higher growth rate than we do, and they don't have the kind of trade deficit that we do. So these kinds of policies can be good for individual workers and their families and good for the economy.
You know, watching the presidential debates, as I've had the privilege, if one wants to use that term, over the last few weeks to do, the issue of the economy is addressed indirectly, and the concerns about joblessness, growth, inequality are almost all telescoped into one issue, especially in the Republican side, but to the Democratic side as well, which is the problem is stems from the growth of illegal, undocumented immigrants into the country, taking away jobs from Americans and driving wages down. What's your take on that issue?
I think immigration is a tough issue for Democrats. I think we need something like the legislation that we almost got last year, comprehensive immigration reform, where on the one hand you do have better border control, but you enforce that not by building a Berlin Wall, but by having serious enforcement at the level of the employer. It's jobs that attract immigrants. We have the ability to punish employers for hiring illegals. At the same time, we now have about 12 million people in this country without documentation. And as a consequence of that, these are the most vulnerable workers we have in the economy. They're afraid of La Migra, the immigration authorities. They have no rights. They don't vote. So a large percentage of working-class voters are outside of the structure of rights, outside the political process, and we need a system for getting people who are in this country to earned citizenship. It's not realistic to send all of them home. But no, if you look at what is causing income inequality, immigration has very little to do with it. In some parts of the country, immigrants are used to drive down wages. There were meatpacking plants in the Middle West that used to be unionized. Now they're, a lot of these jobs are filled by $6 or $7 an hour jobs taken by immigrants. But the union busting occurred long before the immigrants came in. And secondly, if you look at the inequality that's going on at the top of the economy, hedge fund managers making $1 billion a year, or corporate CEOs making 400 times what the average worker makes rather than 40 times back when the economy was performing better, what does immigration have to do with that? So I think in the absence of Democrats offering other policies to produce better jobs for Americans, it's very easy to scapegoat immigrants. And I really worry about people like Lou Dobbs, who I think play on this and attribute far too much of the war against the middle class to immigrants. It's a real recipe for demagoguery.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner, author of the new book, The Squandering of America. Again, the phone number, 333-9455, toll-free line, which is open, 1-800-2255. 800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Yes, I've got a two-part statement perhaps you'd like to comment on. The first one is in this morning's Sunday newspaper, the News Gazette, there's an article in the business section that says our federal government's indebtedness has increased $3 trillion over the past 6 years. Secondly, and my main question, and I'll hang up and listen, is regarding this subprime mess. Virtually nothing has been said about chicanery, criminality of the loan companies in qualifying the people who are going to receive the loans. It seems to me that they had the fiduciary duty to make sure these people were able to pay, but then it seems like they didn't care because they figured, well, if they don't pay, then they'll take over their house. So if you'll comment on those two things, the $3 trillion in 6 years and the scandalous, improper criminality of some of the loan companies. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
And before you answer that, Mr. Kuttner, let me just say that the book deals with both these issues quite extensively, especially the issue of debt. So I know you'd be too modest to mention that, so I'll do so.
Well, those are great questions. Let me take subprime first. I think the scoundrels of the piece include the local mortgage companies that you referred to that made their money whether or not these loans could ever be paid off. They didn't make their money because they would take back the house, because as soon as they made the loan, a middleman converted it into a bond, and the whole thing was financed by the big dogs on Wall Street like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup. So I blame three kinds of players. I blame the big guys on Wall Street who finance these sleazy local mortgage lenders. I blame the local mortgage lenders, but most of all, I blame the regulators. This is exactly the kind of thing that a free market economy does when you let it go haywire. And there were regulations on the books that the Federal Reserve refused to enforce because the Fed claims to believe in free markets except when they go nuts and then the Fed bails them out. This never had to happen. And I think it's tragic that borrowers are being scapegoated in some quarters. A lot of these products were so complicated and so sleazy that a normal American couldn't understand them. And none of this had to happen. Secondly, with regard to the debt, I think there's a lot of fear-mongering about deficits and debts. My problem is not the size of the federal deficit, but what the federal deficit is being used for and how we got it. A federal deficit of maybe 2% of GDP is not a problem as long as the economy is growing at 3% of GDP. And if you use that deficit to finance education and research and early childhood care, you're building a stronger economy. The problem with this deficit is how we got it. How did we get it? We got it by dramatically cutting taxes on the very wealthiest people with the best ability to pay taxes, and by having a war in Iraq, a needless war that costs $200 billion a year. If instead of those uses of the deficit, we had rebuilt our cities and our infrastructure and put money into research and development and job retraining and education and early childhood, that debt would be just beautiful because it would help the economy grow and it would help the economy become more equal. And I think the trap that Democrats get themselves into is instead of arguing against the way public spending is being used, they become the guys with the green eye shades. And, you know, if there's anything worse politically than tax and spend, it's tax and not spend because you're raising people's taxes and not giving them anything back.
Our guest, Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect and author of the brand-new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Mr. Kuttner, if people want to learn more about your book and or about The American Prospect, are there websites they can go to?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that. The book has its own website, squanderingofamerica.com, and the prospect is www.prospect.org. Given the title of your show, Bob, can I say something about Medium and how Medium matters?
In fact, I was going to ask you that. You great minds are thinking alike today. Please do.
Well, I think the emblematic case was the other week when Tim Russert was beating up on the Democratic candidates and asking them what they were going to do about the impending collapse of Social Security. Everybody knows Social Security is collapsing. Are you going to raise taxes or are you going to cut benefits? And I was just appalled that everybody took the bait. You know, Obama said, well, I'll raise taxes on people making more than $97,000 a year. And he got whacked for that because that's the upper middle class. And Hillary said, well, I'm going to appoint a commission, and she got whacked for that because that's typical Hillary. Nobody had the facts or the nerve to say the whole case against Social Security being insolvent is phony. It's trumped up. It's faked by the people who want to privatize the thing. The only reason that there's a slight projected shortfall in the Social Security accounts is that George W. Bush's appointees on the trustees board of the Social Security system project economic growth at just 1.8%, which nobody else in Washington believes. Everybody thinks the economy is going to grow at between 2 and 3%. And if you use pessimistic numbers, you're going to get pessimistic assumptions. But all of these media cliches about how Democrats ought to scuttle to the center, about Social Security is going bankrupt, about universal health insurance being something we can't afford when actually it's the only way we can solve the crisis of health insurance. Too many Democrats get intimidated by these media cliches.
You know, Robert Kuttner, I've got the phone bank is filled with callers, so I'm about to turn the show over to the listeners.
All right, now I'll shut up and listen.
Yeah, let's go right now, if we can, to line two. Champagne, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner, author of The Squandering of America.
Hello. My question is what you see as a solution to, or, you know, response to, what seems to be happening is the moving of jobs, you know, out of the United States because of higher wages to especially Asian countries. We've seen this, you know, in the blue-collar jobs, which is why the industries that were so strongly unionized, in many cases, they don't even exist in this country anymore. And we've now begun to see the loss of many white-collar jobs as well. Software development is being outsourced to India, and a lot of administrative call centers, a lot of those jobs are also being moved there because it's a lot less expensive to do it. What do you see as a solution or any kind of hope that that as wages increase in the United States, it inevitably leads to those positions?
Well, again, it's a great question, and there's a three-part answer. Some of the outsourcing occurs because countries like China cheat. They use all kinds of subsidies, mercantilist strategies that would be illegal under the trading system if they were enforced, to induce or coerce companies to relocate to China. Then they fail to give workers and citizens the kinds of rights that are normal in much of the rest of the trading world. So if you required companies like countries like China to provide a normal degree of social regulation and worker rights, wages would go up in China. That would solve a piece of the problem. But as you point out, India is a democracy, and a lot of these jobs are being outsourced to India, so it would not solve all of the problem. I think the United States has the wherewithal to have industrial policies to become energy independent, which would also have the benefit of reducing global climate change, would create a lot of competitive industries and new jobs at home. I also think that a lot of the service economy cannot be outsourced. Hospital jobs, with the exception maybe of radiologists reading X-rays and CAT scans by remote control in Mumbai, but most hospital jobs are hands-on jobs. And I think we need a national commitment so that every human service job is a good job. We're never going to get all the factory jobs back, because even if you solve the outsourcing problem, manufacturing is becoming so productive that automation is going to reduce jobs. But that doesn't mean we can't produce jobs in this country that pay a living wage. And so you need a combination of fairer trade, more symmetrical practices in trade, coupled with a national commitment to create good jobs at home.
Before we go to the next caller, and I want to assure all the callers waiting in the lines, I will get to you, so please do be patient. I want to follow up on that, because you talk about the Democratic Party at the end of the book, and you are, I think, a supporter in general of the Democratic Party. And you talk about its failure on issues like this because of the influence of big money and moneyed influence on Democrats, just like they influence Republican politicians.
I don't want to tar the whole Democratic
Party. Exactly. I was just going to ask you if there are signs of hope in the party, not just in the backbenchers and the Sherrod Browns who's been on this program, but among candidates for president right now.
You know, events make great presidents. Roosevelt wasn't Roosevelt before he became president. Lincoln wasn't Lincoln. On the other hand, there were some presidents like Hoover or Carter who failed to rise to the occasion. I think it's too early to know whether there's the spark of greatness in one of the Democratic nominees. I think the economy is going to be pretty rocky next year, and one of two things will happen. The Democratic nominee either will rise to the occasion and potentially be a transformative president, or the nominee will be a failed president and might not even get elected president.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again, Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect and author of the brand new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've touched on... I'll just jump to one of the comments. In terms of education being a cure-all for this, in terms at least of the humanities, there was a number of years ago, there was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education recommending that graduate students not go into the humanities because of the dearth of jobs in that area. And in terms of education being a cure-all in general, so many of these jobs with computers are really, they really don't require, I think you touched on this, any real knowledge of computers. It's just simply which buttons you push and how to go here and there on the keys and so forth. And my general impression, I'm just going to jump down here, I get the impression the economy is headed for some sort of very strange type of depression, not like the 1920s or 30s, but where there will be very depressed areas and significant sections of the economy that will not directly affect the wealthy in the upper class. And just very briefly, did you write an earlier book, I'm going to hang up and listen, on some of the rules that have been changed in American society in terms of economic policy? And thank you.
Well, I wrote an early book called Everything for Sale, The Virtues and Limits of Markets, which talks about what parts of the economy work well as markets and what parts of the economy don't. I think if you're talking about the humanities, why do we educate people in the humanities? We educate people in the humanities because we want well-educated citizens. We want literate citizens who've learned from the great wisdom of cultures in the past. There's not a linear relationship between knowing Shakespeare and being a good computer scientist, but I would rather have a society where people are broadly well-educated. And at the same time, there are things we need to do in a narrower sense to be productive and to be competitive. I think whether we have a steep recession or a depression depends on what policies we pursue, which in turn depend on what kind of leadership we get.
Let us now go to our next phone caller for Robert Kuttner, the author of the new book, The Squandering of America, a cell phone caller on line 4. You're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Thank you very much. Enjoying your show a lot. Previously, you talked about the ideal of economic growth with a more equitable distribution of benefits, wherein the entire society does well. And you talked about how conservatives, their policy does not necessarily lead to this. So from my perspective, I would tell you that I think that they don't care if their policy doesn't lead to this, because it seems to me that their ideal is to construct or to have the circumstances allow individuals to make as much money as possible without concern for the effect on other individuals. And I see that as potentially quite destructive if it gets too far out of balance. So I'd like to know whether you think I'm seeing that clearly or if I'm missing something. And so I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Mr. Kuttner?
Well, that's precisely the conservative ideology. I mean, you can fit the conservative ideology into 8 words. one having to do with the economy and the government, the other having to do with personal responsibility. Markets work, governments don't, and poor people reflect poor values. That's nine words. And radical individualism has had appeal at certain points in American history, and then radical individualism and the failure of government to inject balance creates calamities, and then the pendulum swings back the other way. Sometimes it's a calamity in slow motion, which is what we've had for 30 years. Sometimes it's a more abrupt one. And I hope the politics of our own era is equal to the task of restoring balance. Otherwise, it could get very, very nasty.
One of the areas of interest, and you write about this a bit at the end of the book, but is the what's going on in the Republican Party and among conservatives, given they've been in power and certainly in dominance pretty much for the last two and a half, 3 decades, that it's really doesn't seem to have the same magical power, the arguments that they did a decade ago.
Well, you know, this is a country where nothing succeeds like success, and the flip side of that is nothing fails like failure. And from the point of view of the average person, this has not been a good period. Some individuals have thrived, but for the vast majority of people, it's become a period of greater insecurity, greater instability. And I think the challenge is to make this explicitly political, not to have this simply be taken as the private tragedy or the private challenge or the private problem of individuals. Somebody who is stressed out trying to juggle kids and work and having to choose between a sick child and maybe losing their job and feeling that I'm a bad father or a bad mother, people need to understand that that horrible choice is a product of political failure. It's a product of the way the rules are rigged. It's not because you're a bad parent. And that's the role of leadership. My favorite paragraph in the book is a line that I wish I'd written myself, but it was written by my colleague Ellen Goodman, and I quote it with full credit. And Ellen wrote, social change occurs when people learn what they already know. And she was talking about the feminist movement where women tacitly understood that when help wanted ads were coded, help wanted male, help wanted female, and all the good jobs were help wanted male. And you all know the other things that existed in pre-feminist America. Women knew that something was wrong, but that tacit knowledge had to become explicit knowledge, and that required a political movement. Same thing with the civil rights movement. Same thing with the industrial workers movement of the 30s and the populist revolt of the 1880s and 1890s. And you need a chemistry where there's organizing at the grassroots and leadership at the top to validate that organizing, and then you can have a profound change.
My guest, Robert Kuttner, author of The Squandering of America. My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Let's go back to the phone lines again to some very patient callers. Line 1, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Yeah, great program, good conversation. I'm a peak oil guy, and I try to read various websites almost on a daily basis, and some of the more florid ones are predicting economically a train wreck, a meltdown. One guy was saying a 1,000-point drop in the Dow this month, the month of December. And then Bernanke comes and goes to, was it South Carolina, North Carolina, 3 weeks before the next Fed meeting and starts talking about a headwind for the economy or for the consumer. You're talking about a rocky thing. I think the Fed and are sort of scared out of their wits right now, and they're trying to tell the markets that there's going to be another rate cut. And 3 weeks ahead of the next meeting, it seems to me that maybe something's brewing. So any further insight into where we might be going in the next 6 months, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks a lot.
You know, Robert Kuttner, before you answer that, some of our listeners might not be familiar with what the Fed is and who Bernanke is. Maybe you could give a little background for them.
Well, the Federal Reserve is our central bank. It's charged with regulating the money supply and interest rates, and in a crisis with being the lender of the last resort. And this is a crisis, and the Fed is functioning as lender of last resort. It's flooding credit markets with money so that credit markets don't seize up just because there's all this junky paper as a result of the subprime meltdown that nobody wants to buy. And every time the panic has deepened, Bernanke either cuts rates, he's the chair of the Fed, or signals that he's going to cut rates at the next monthly meeting, which the caller's right, is what he did in that recent speech, and then the stock market has a couple of good days. You mentioned peak oil. I think even if oil doesn't peak for another 20 years, we're certainly going to run out of it sooner or later, global climate change is the kind of epical catastrophe that, as Sir Nicholas Stern wrote in the famous Stern Report last year, it's history's greatest case of market failure, meaning that markets did not correctly price energy, either in terms of the eventual depletion of carbon-based fuels or in terms of the effect of carbon-based fuels on the environment. And here's another case where markets don't work, and if we are not to face either economic or ecological catastrophe, government has to play a role. So, yes, the regulators are very, very frightened because they did not expect this to happen. They drank their own Kool-Aid. They convinced themselves that financial markets were self-regulating, and obviously they're not.
Let us go now to yet another caller, this one from Champaign County on line two. You're on the air with Robert Kuttner.
Hi. I don't know whether you can actually handle it. My question is, about the character of this crisis is as diffuse as the last one, I think. And but I've been hearing these things about how bond insurance people are so hesitant to insure bonds that muni bonds are actually sort of in jeopardy, and that places like Chicago can't issue them. You hear something related, I guess, in a way, that this investment fund in Florida is so questionable that it can't issue money that it's typically lends to educational institutions. And I don't know whether there's any way to... I've read a little around on the net on it, but maybe you have an article upcoming on that part of the crisis, and you don't have to answer it. But I wanted to also point out that we don't learn much from these debates, but the Democratic debate that featured Hillary Clinton using this line about how we're not going to fix Social Security on the middle class, and Obama says only 6 or 7% of working people actually make more than $90,000, so the cap will affect not the middle class. Now, she looked shocked to me, and I don't know if she's shocked because Obama would break a taboo and actually say that, or whether she just doesn't know that that's how few people are in the class that she typically runs with from when she was, you know, on the chair on the board of Walmart and whatever. And then I'm sure I'm going beyond the bounds of also wanting to talk about tax fairness and the way the hedge funds are being tacked on capital gains, and whether you think the Democrats are really going to challenge that in any effective way, since some of their best donors are making money on
right.
in that area. And I'll appreciate your answer.
Sure.
And again, Mr. Kuttner, before you dive in, I just want to say in your behalf that your book, The Squandering of America, has a detailed and extensive, at least half the book, deals with the deregulation of financial markets, the growth of hedge funds, of private equity, and their implications, oftentimes quite disastrous for our economic health.
Well, you know, on the first question about these financial companies that make their money by insuring bonds, the phrase house of cards comes to mind, that you have financial engineering piled on top of financial engineering piled on top of financial engineering, all of which is interlinked. So if you have speculative bonds, and people feel that, well, that's okay, I can invest in that because that pays a higher rate of return, and then somebody else is making money because they don't really think these are ever going to get into trouble by insuring those bonds, and then the whole thing starts to unwind, each layer of the house of cards collapses. That's what's starting to happen. That's why Bernanke is throwing money at Wall Street in the hope that additional liquidity, as they say, will keep the game going. And on your other question about Obama, the issue of whose taxes we ought to raise to save Social Security is a false issue because Social Security is not in trouble in any meaningful way. Now, on the question of progressive taxation and raising taxes on the wealthy, I don't think it's prudent to start with people who make $97,000 a year. I think there are a lot of upper middle class families, and they tend to vote who are only a little bit better off than middle-class families. And we don't want to tell those people that if you elect the Democrats, we're going to raise your taxes. There's so much money concentrated at the upper extreme. I would start the tax increase at about $200,000 a year, which is what Bill Clinton, to his credit, did when he raised taxes back in 1993 to set the deficit on a downward course. I would concentrate all of the tax increases on the top 2% of the population. They're the people who've gotten the big windfall from the rules of the economy. They've gotten the big windfall from the Bush tax cuts. And your hedge fund point is a very good point about the paralysis of the Democrats. I mean, these are people who make astronomical windfalls, and because of the way the windfalls are treated as capital gains, a lot of these guys pay taxes at a lower rate than the person who cleans their office. So if the Democrats don't have the nerve to propose and vote for higher taxes on hedge fund windfalls, God help us.
Robert Kuttner, I wonder, before we wrap up, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I studied economics as an undergraduate in the early 1970s, and I remember then that Milton Friedman was taught, and that branch of economics was taught, but it was always dismissed as sort of marginal and sort of not to be taken especially seriously. And I know that in the subsequent years, this has become a dominant part of
right.
the economics curriculum, and it's become far more mathematical than I remember the neoclassical era of the 60s and 70s. And recently, I was talking to someone who works in business. He says the last place you would go to learn how our economy actually works is the Department of Economics. And
oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, most economists don't study economic history. Too many economists are math majors who realize that they can use their equations to have a kind of a one-size-fits-all analysis of the economy. I have great respect for the economists who actually study institution and history, but there are fewer and fewer of them. And I studied economics as a political scientist. I mean, I don't have an advanced degree in economics. I have my degrees in political science. But that's how you have to understand economics, because economics is political, and although the book, The Squandering of America, is about the economy, it's really a book about politics.
Now, what are the hopeful signs? We only have about a minute left. As you're looking forward to our listeners who, you know, are going to hopefully go see your book or read it, The Squandering of America, or go to the American Prospect website, what are the hopeful signs you would point people to keep their eye on in the next 6 months, year and a half, for people who want to find a hopeful political solution to this problem?
I think the hopeful sign is that events will force whoever the Democratic nominee is to take all of this stuff much more seriously and to vault over some of the conventional wisdom of what needs to be done. Otherwise, I think there will be either a failed presidency or even a Republican president, because if the Democrats don't speak to the lived experience of ordinary people won't be motivated to vote for them. And I think I have enough hope that the situation is serious enough that I think you're going to find a rather bolder general election than a lot of the things you've been hearing in some of the primary debates.
And the downside? What
downside is it could be very serious. And I think events, both in terms of what's facing ordinary people and in terms of what's facing the financial economy, are really crying out for another great period of proactive government. I think the constituency is there for it. The question is whether leadership will seize the moment.
Our guest today has been Robert Kuttner, authoring of The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Robert Kuttner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for his terrific work. And I want to thank Brett Polson for engineering the show as well. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll see you all in 167 hours.